The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. Nice to have you with us today. Very full show. We'll be talking about the latest on nutrients that can protect us from radiation. Yesterday, I spoke about homeopathic remedies. Today, I'll speak about the kind of herbs, vitamins, minerals that we're all able to get. From Ronnie Cummins, approaching the collapse, don't panic, go organic. And then from Bruce Levine, who we've had on this program many times, three things that must happen for us to rise up and defeat the corporatocracy, from Alternet. Then, not to be outdone by that, Richard Clark, how oligopoly plus oligarchy is leading to corporate communism in America. I didn't have a chance to get to that yesterday. Hopefully we'll today. My guest in the third part of our program today is one of those remarkable mind guests. He is Professor Joel Bakken. He is a lawyer, professor of constitutional and economic law. He is a recognized legal scholar internationally, from the University of British Columbia, a Rhodes Scholar, and a law degree from both Oxford University and Harvard Universities. What are we going to talk about? The corporate domination of children's development purely for profit and wealth. What does that mean? It means that probably 90% of what your child's going to desire, ask for, and how they're going to act is all manipulated by corporations wanting to make sure that you do the right thing and buy your kids what they are putting in your child's mind that that child cannot live without. So we'll deal with that in that segment. Let's begin with the latest on health and healing. There's an herb that has a lot of good uses, certainly for diabetes or low energy levels and hypoglycemia. It helps it both if your sugar is high and sugar is low. It's called ashwagandha. A-S-H-W-A-G-A-N-D-H-A. What makes it remarkable is it's in the same family as ginseng. It's an adaptogenic herb. And that means it can help your mind, your body, in adapting to stress. According to Donna Rowe, it, quote, is indigenous to India. It's used and studied in Ayurvedic practices for centuries. Now, ashwagandha helps its users to remain calm during times of stress, whether emotional or physical, and as with hard labor or vigorous exercise, an ashwagandha is a powerful, soothing tonic. It's useful to restore vitality and prolong longevity. Its antispasmodic effects have been used in the treatment of asthma, and it's used in pregnancy to relax the uterus to stop miscarriages. And also, there are clinical studies that show that it really makes a difference in helping your blood sugar remain normal. So that's a very important nutrient to have, and it's non-toxic. I've gotten a lot of response after I showed in New York and Los Angeles, knocking on the devil's door, our nuclear nightmare. What do we do if there is an accident and we happen to be exposed? Well, understand that radiation damages the cells in two ways. And meaning the cells, mean it alters your DNA. It can produce large quantities of free radicals, which can damage many areas of the cell, especially the DNA. And when these radioactive particles pass through the cellular fluids, they produce superoxide and hydroxyl radicals, and those are extremely destructive. So when you get an X-ray, you can live with the effects of that X-ray for a month or two in what it's doing as far as creating these free radicals. Now, any kind of radioactive particles in cells overwhelm the protective actions of various DNA repair enzymes due to the enormous amount of free radical production. And another reason that adding, let's say, digestive enzymes to the diet can once again help be a life-saving situation, because the cellular repair mechanisms are based upon enzymes. Turns out that most of the antioxidant vitamins and minerals that are most effective also have anti-radiation effects. Why? Because they stop free radicals, including those lipid peroxidation inhibiting properties. So what would be at the top of my list of things to take if I was going to get an X-ray, or if I fly on an airplane because you're getting background radiation, or if I'm exposed to radiation in any form? Top of my list, curcumin. Curcumin is a flavonoid, and it's extremely beneficial. It has anti-cancer, anti-inflammatory effects, and it also helps stop a lot of brain degeneration. The normal amount people would take is about 100 milligrams. I would suggest 5,000 milligrams. Then beta-1,3-1,6-D-glucan. Now, these are all derived from brewer's yeast. And for most people, they can get 200 to 500 milligrams a day. You take that after you have been exposed to radiation, and it has a powerful immune stimulant and radioprotective effect. In fact, D-glucan, G-L-U-C-A-N, is extremely beneficial in helping your red blood cells, in helping your leukocyte levels, your platelet levels. So it's all good. Then you want folate and methylcobalamin, niacinamide, and vitamin B6. They all work synergistically to protect and repair your very sensitive genetic material. I would suggest 1 milligram of folate, naturally occurring folate, or is the best way. Then B12, I would suggest 3 to 4 milligrams. Niacinamide up to flushing, that could be anywhere from 2 to 500 milligrams. And remember, if you take too much, your skin's going to turn very red, you'll get itchy, and you'll perspire, and you'll think you're having a stroke. It's just you're flushing. That's why people who are having migraine headaches need to hyper-stimulate the flow of blood, and that does so. Vitamin B6 generally at 75 milligrams, and zinc at about 20 milligrams. They all work synergistically. Then you have N-acetylcysteine, or NAC. I'm suggesting 1,000 milligrams. Now, what happens is that's a precursor to the all-inclusive best antioxidants we have in our body for detoxifying, glutathione. Then you have selenium at 200 micrograms and vitamin C up to about 10,000 milligrams a day in buffered form. And between 3 and 5,000 milligrams of vitamin C a day helps almost double the dose that are protecting us from radiation exposure. So that's just some things you can do to make a difference. Now, Indian curry spice cures food poisoning. This is from the Times of India, and here's what it says. Quote, scientists from the University of Beira in Portugal have found that oil from the common Indian spice is toxic to a broad range of harmful bacteria, and its use in foods and in clinical agents could prevent foodborne illnesses and even treat antibiotic-resistant infections. The researchers tested coriander seed oil against 12 bacterial strains, including the E. coli and Salmonella and Bacillus cereus and Staphylococcus aureus, or MRSA. Of the tested strains, all showed reduced growth, and most were killed by solutions containing 1.6% coriander oil. Now, this study not only shows that coriander oil also has an antibacterial effect, but provides an explanation for how it works, which was not previously understood. Here's what it says, and this is from Medical Microbiology, the peer-reviewed journal. And Dr. Dominique's quote, the results indicate that coriander oil damages the membrane surrounding the bacterial cell. This disrupts the barrier between the cell and its environment and inhibits essential processes, including respiration, which ultimately leads to death of the bacterial cell. Now, just imagine for a moment all the people who die, which are a lot, from one of the worst infections you can get, the MRSA infection, the Staphylococcus aureus bacterium. If every hospital had a spray solution of, let's say, 2% coriander oil, it could help save a person's life. But I also believe it should be put on all sores because it could help that as well. So add this as something that we now know about that otherwise we wouldn't, that can help save a life, especially when people have serious bacterial infections. One more reason to become a vegetarian: it's good for your kidneys. A new study shows that sticking to a healthy vegetarian diet can help kidney disease patients avoid accumulating toxic levels of phosphorus in their bodies. As we know, kidney disease patients must limit their phosphorus intake, as high levels of the mineral can lead to heart attack and death in kidney patients. While medical guidelines recommend low phosphorus diets for patients with chronic kidney disease, phosphorus content is not listed on food labels. And what they found at the Indiana University School of Medicine was that a vegetarian diet without the meat, and hence not the high phosphorus, was very beneficial in a group of patients. So for those of you who are vegans, all the better. And this was published in the Clinical Journal of the American Society of Nephrology. That's good information for kidney patients. And finally, women who take vitamins have fewer preemies. This is the newest study. And they looked at 36,000 pregnant women and looked at their diet and their vitamin use. Poor nutrition was shown to play a major role in pregnancy complications, such as preterm births and poor growth rates within the womb. And the new study strengthens the link that taking your multiple vitamins is good for you and good for your developing fetus. This was published in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition. And one last study here. This ties into something we spoke about yesterday. And once again, I'm at the airport and I'm watching this television program. And last night, I think it was CNN, had a discussion with a leading doctor on Alzheimer's who said, too bad this famous woman coach has this, but there's nothing really you can do. Oh, there's so much you can do. This is the latest. Vitamin C dissolves toxic brain protein in Alzheimer's patients. This is from the Journal of Biological Chemistry. Wonder if anyone at CNN ever actually does their homework. I'll quote this. Journal of Biological Chemistry reports the finding of researchers at Lund University in Sweden of the ability of vitamin C to dissolve amyloid beta, a substance consisting of misfolded protein aggregates found in the brains of Alzheimer's disease patients that causes cell death and memory loss. Because there is currently no cure for Alzheimer's disease, the discovery of any potential treatment that could retard its progression is of tremendous importance in light of aging population in many parts of the world. For the research, and then it goes on to talk about how they did this using the vitamin C, quote, when we treated brain tissue from mice suffering from Alzheimer's disease with vitamin C, we could see that the toxic protein aggregates were dissolved. Our results show a previously unknown model for how vitamin C affects amyloid plaques. Well, that's good information. Of course, no one's going to use it because it's in a peer-reviewed independent scientific journal. And American doctors don't read it. Scientists don't care. They only care about what they're doing. And so nothing changes. Then ask Marie McGovern, how much vitamin C is she taking a day? Oh, did we forget? Yes, we did. She's reversed her Alzheimer's by at least 90% and is able to function normally today or before she would be dead. But will they look at her? No way in the world. They can't possibly do it. You know, it's like UFOs. If you can find a legitimate way to look at 15,000 case reports and find that each and every one of those 14,909 were false, you know, weather balloons or whatever it is. But what if one you can't? Then only one establishes it exists. So all it takes is one to reverse it and to have the proof to show it can be done. But medicine is generally about 25 years behind the curve, meaning from the time they know they're doing something wrong, it takes 25 years to stop it. And something should be done right, it takes about 25 years to engage it, unless there's a big push by the pharmaceutical or special medical implementation companies to see that all the doctors are, in effect, bribed to use it. But getting something bad out, that takes a long time. If you doubt me, look at silicone breast implants. Look in synthetic estrogen therapy. Look at the Dalcon Chill, the Copper Coral 7. All these things that mammography that women have been using that are known to cause negative reactions, far outweighing any benefit, they're still in use. I'm Gary Noll, back in a moment. Please stay with us. Welcome, all of you. I'm Gary Noll. Now, from our environmental section, from Ronnie Cummins, so-called business as usual is neither sustainable nor even possible, he says. And just as an aside, you know what no one's paying attention to in the mainstream? Of course, Mike Rupert and others who are more attuned to the reality of the world are, and Gerald Celante has always got his radar in the air, is that we've passed peak oil. What that means, we're not going to run out of oil. There'll always be oil, but there'll be less of it. And a lot less of it. Because India and China want everything we have. And that takes oil. That takes petroleum. A toaster, a hairdryer, a new car. All that takes petroleum. Which means that you now have 500 million people who are now entering the middle class, who can afford to pay for things that previously they could not, which means more oil will be diverted to that, which means that now we're on the downside of peak, that over the next 5 years, I predict that we'll see the cost of everything that had petroleum as a part of it increasing. It'll be very common in 5 years from now to pay $10 for gasoline and think that's a bargain. Of course, the wiser people already will have moved on to water and other types of fuel, but we won't move as a society in the right direction. We never have. We'll have to be forced to make that a move. So when you look at what we're doing today, it's virtually non-sustainable. What we have is we have an out-of-control energy corporations. Wall Street's out of control. The Pentagon's out of control. Agribusiness, biotechnology, and genetic engineering, they're out of control. The endangered politicians have driven us to the brink. They tell us, don't worry, trust the experts. Things will soon return to normal, like yesterday. But then again, we in the independent field know reality and common sense, and we know they're on the wrong side of history and the truth. Who would have guessed that in 1 week we would have the worst earthquake in the eastern United States in anyone's lifetime, and now about to have the worst hurricane, both in 1 week? gee whiz, wonder if that could pose any problem at all for the nuclear power plants up the East Coast. You see, remember what I've been saying over the last 6 months? I've said it 100 times. People who are so self-confident something won't happen until it does happen. And then everybody says, but why didn't you warn me? Why didn't you tell me? And I say, would you have listened? Did you care? We have on a daily basis, we have extreme weather, crop failures, commodity speculation, land grabs, escalating prices, soil degradation, depleted aquifers, routine contamination, food-related disease, mass hunger, and that represents the new norm for food and farming. Now, the global agricultural system, with the exception of the rapidly growing organic sector, rests upon a shaky foundation. Why? Patented seeds, genetically engineered crops, expensive and destructive chemical and energy-intensive inputs, factory farms, monoculture production, eroding soil, unsustainable water use, taxpayer subsidies, and long-distance hauling and distribution, including massive imports that amount to about 15% of the U.S. food supply. What does that add up to? Well, from my perspective, being here every day and seeing this, it adds up to non-sustainability. Whether it becomes a disaster, it will never be a disaster for those who can afford to avert disaster. That's about 1% of the American population. But for everyone else, we're in a perfect storm. Oh, and did I forget that we are also the sickest nation in the world per population? 57% of all Americans suffer from chronic illnesses. That's chronic illnesses. That doesn't even include acute illnesses. And then we're in the ultimate recession. It was Lester Brown who coined the phrase ultimate recession in his new book, World on the Edge, and that could develop at any time, precipitated by extreme weather and crop failures on a massive scale. Now, a growing number of nations, including the oil giants and China, are now scrambling to secure overseas farmland to feed their domestic populations. We've discussed that many times in this program. And world groceries and supermarkets, including the U.S., have on the average only a 4-day supply of food on hand. That's it. An oil shock and global disease pandemics and prolonged drought in the American heartland. In fact, I just read an article a week ago from the San Antonio newspaper, front page, that the state of Texas is in the worst drought in history and it's only going to get worse. Our nuclear meltdown could just set off a global food panic. Supermarket shelves and grain silos would be stripped bare within a short period of time. Who would have thought? Who would have believed that any of this would be possible? Now, are you and those in your local community or family ready for this? Peak food, we've reached it. Peak oil, we're past it. Peak water, we're past it. Peak soil, we're way past it. Any discussion, maybe Keith Olbermann, Rachel Maddow, maybe they're talking about this on the left. No, they're not. How about on the right? Oh, they don't believe in any of this. Abundance forever. Growth without restriction and temperance. Reality check. For those of you who are independent-minded and not a part of the ramrod rigid ideologues, beliefs, world grain reserves amount to less than 75-day supply. Let me say that again. In the entire world, the whole planet, we have 75 days worth of food. Harvests of strategic food grains and cereals have basically leveled off or even decreased, with enormous amounts of acreage now providing fuel for cars instead of food for people. At the same time, affordable fossil fuel energy supplies have peaked, with the world increasingly dependent upon extreme oil and natural gas extraction, which they're selling. If you watch any television, and I was watching last night, I saw this commercial about how we want to extract this wonderful oil in the sand of Canada, and it's going to be so cheap to do and so natural. And no, it's not. It's a ripoff, and it's another investment bubble. I'm telling you now that the entire gas hydrofracking is nothing more than a group of Ponzi bubbles. They're going to go broke on this thing. Plus, they're doing deep sea and Arctic drilling. Boy, that's safe and smart. tar sands and fracking. Gee whiz, could we get any dumber? Accelerating the prices of petroleum-based farm inputs, as well as the food distribution and the processing costs, and billions of people in the global south are now spending 70% of their household income on food. In the United States, it's 11%. Hydrologists and agronomists warn that peak water is here, and when the already limited availability of clean drinking water from underground aquifers are used for crop irrigation, which supplies 20% of U.S. and 40% of world grains, exponentially decreases, then peak soil's also on us, where we're simply creating desertification. And what I'm doing now, I'll be flying over parts of countries showing how fast the desert is approaching. Do you know that China has lost 28,000 villages because of the encroachment of the desert? Oh, gee whiz. Boy, that was smart planning. Yeah, let's be so good at planning and financing major cities and developing cheap products to export outside and depress our currency so that we can afford to sell stuff around the world. What about that desert? What about clean water? What about helping our soil? Don't worry about any of that. Yeah. And now you have the fastest encroachment of the desert of any country in the world. Right now, one-fifth of all the land base in China is desert. And it could easily double in the next 5 years. So wonder if there could be a problem there. Where are you going to relocate 400 million people? You got a place for them? Fortunately, over the past 40 years, a new generation of organic farmers and ranchers have proliferated, building up the traditional wisdom and practices of indigenous and traditional farmers for the past 10,000 years. And a growing core of organic farmers and gardeners are producing increasing amounts of healthy, nutritious foods without the use of chemical fertilizers, pesticides, or genetically engineered seeds or animal drugs. And at the same time, these 21st century organic stewards of the land are consuming far less, 50% less of fossil fuels and water. And study after study has demonstrated that organic small farms in the developing world outproduce chemical and genetically engineered farms by a factor of 2 to 1. While in the industrial nations, sustainable organic yields are comparable to normal farms. The burning question then becomes, how do we build up a stronger movement that can promote and scale up organic, local, regionally based systems of food farming? At the same time, we're being fought by the FDA and USDA, Monsanto, who want to destroy organic and destroy heirloom seeds. Well, you've got to wake people up. Three easy things we can do. Now, one thing we can do, step up public education and conscious raising. We now have a major threshold of raising public awareness that faces us. We've got to get some documentaries done. We've got to do more documentaries. We have to do maybe a reality show where someone goes out and like 40 Acres of the Mule and starts a homestead from scratch and shows what life could be like when you take the best at what you have and you reapply that to a homestead. That's one idea. And by the way, do you think we're a few? No, the 30 million households comprising of 75 million people are now buying organic foods on a regular basis. 56% of U.S. consumers say they would prefer organic foods for a lot of different reasons. So we are not insignificant. Second, step up the campaign against industrial agriculture and genetic engineering. We need a really hard-hitting documentary against genetic engineering. I'm working on one now, but I'd like to see 4 or 5 of them out there because genetic engineering has never been proven safe in humans or animals, but they want to control it all. And thirdly, link up with movements local to global. Reducing global poverty and war and stabilizing the climate go hand in hand. The best way to reduce global rural poverty and conflict and war is through land reform and sustainable organic farming practices. With land reform and technical assistance, millions of organic farms in the global south can develop and prosper. and helping the world's poorest people, especially women, to produce far more food with less or no fossil fuel or chemical inputs. This organic revolution will enable at least 3 billion people right now to get out of abject poverty. Those are my thoughts and those also of the commentary. Back in a moment with my guests. Please stay with us. Welcome all of you, I'm Gary Nall. Yesterday I had on Susan Lindauer, and she is a U.S. intelligence agent, and she was the one who claims that she had absolute proof of that the 9/11 disaster was going to happen, and she made some really strong statements, and I invited her back today. Then yesterday afternoon, she shared some additional information with Richard Gill, my producer, which was rather startling. So I said, well, I'd like to offer that up to our audience, but I need some independent proof of this. Can you get me some affidavits? And one affidavit has come in already, and I've read it. The second is on its way. And so what I'm going to do is I'm setting aside my progressive commentary hour, Monday evening at 7 p.m., just for her, nothing else. And however long that interview goes, that's how long it goes. If it's an hour, good. If it's 2 hours, we'll keep it rolling. But I can assure you, based upon what I have been told and based upon what we know today and what evidence has been coming in the form of signed, sworn affidavits from reputable people, that if she is telling the truth, then we have really better pay attention. Because unlike other guests I've had on who've given specific information that contradicts the 9/11 commission, this goes beyond that. How she is still alive is beyond me. I'm surprised that they haven't offed her some time ago. And maybe they will, which we hope not. But boy, does she have some damning evidence to share. But I wanted some independent verification before I went public with it. I didn't want to limit it to a 15-minute guest segment. So she'll be on Monday, 7 p.m. You won't want to miss it. You will not want to miss it. So put the word out to your friends. A very unusual discussion with documents and details that go in depth to back up her assertions. So we'll have her on uninterrupted for the full hour or longer Monday on the Progressive Commentary Hour, and you can hear that by going to progressiveradionetwork.com, progressiveradionetwork.com. If for some reason you should forget that, go to garynall.com, there's a link. Now let's go over, oh, and one other thing before we go to Professor Joel Bacon, who's on our line right now. We're gaining enormous amount of momentum for the September 21st evening with Vandana Shiva, Carl Grossman, Greg Palast. We have a whole panel of outstanding experts who are challenging the safety of our nuclear facilities. We're going to show the full version, uncut of the director's cut, which no one has seen yet, of Knocking on the Devil's Door, a Nuclear Nightmare. This will be at the Ethical Culture City in New York, followed by an hour-and-a-half panel. I'm also going to bring in some experts on solar flares. These are physicists, astrophysicists, because I want people to see how real this threat is. This is not science fiction. This is real. And what the likely scenarios are if we do not get these surge protectors at these stations and these maiden stations or substations, what will happen to all the electricity in the places affected and including all those nuclear facilities. So they will also be there. Anyhow, my suggestion is now that college students start putting posters up and senior citizens, health, food stores, food co-ops. Let's start getting the word out The worldwide movement to close down nuclear facilities begins September 21st in a unified effort. We'll be video streaming this live throughout the world. We'll have countries all over the place joining in and watching. If you would like to join us, and seats are very limited, and we will absolutely sell this out, and this is a nonprofit event, you can call 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. I'll be there. I'll be the commentator. We will have some whistleblowers. We'll have new information, and I'm not going to reveal at this moment a very interesting strategy that we believe will make the difference in closing Indian Point. I'm not going to give the nuclear industry any heads up on this. And there's a major campaign, a major pushback on their side now to convince people that nuclear facilities are safe and important and green, and they're going to put millions behind them. They own the politicians. They own the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. They own the media as far as influencing it. And they actually own it, Westinghouse and General Electric. So both of whom own nuclear facilities. So we're going to be sharing a lot of insights you did not know before. And you'll get two copies of the film when you come. So please give us a call. And as every single showing thus far has been filled, this is our last full night on this. So give us a call at 877-627-5065. Also, we're going to need people next week because we're doing a mailing of about 5,000 of these films out to legislators, media, people, environmental groups. Now, Jason's number to call if you'd like to volunteer some time helping is 646-926-5438. 646-926-5438. Now let's, 9428. Now let's go over and say hello to Professor Joel. Do you pronounce it Bacon or Backen?
Backen, as in backing a car in.
Backing a car in, all right. I mentioned earlier in our program that you're a lawyer and professor of constitutional and economic law and an internationally recognized legal scholar at the University of British Columbia. You're also a Rhodes Scholar and you have law degrees from Oxford and Harvard Universities. You're the author of the documentary, The Corporation, which I really enjoyed, and The Pathological Pursuit of Profit and Power, which won 23 international awards, including Sundance Cinema Documentary Award. And so, first, we appreciate you being with us today.
Well, thanks for having me on. I really enjoyed being on with you a few years back, talking about The Corporation book and film.
Well, now we want to talk about the corporate domination of children's development for profit and wealth. And as you mentioned the last time you were on this program, we spoke about the pathological nature of large corporations, which included your assessment of the DSM battery test results for mental illness, which applied to corporate culture. So I would like you to begin by defining for us, please, again, the corporate psychology of pathological greed and control that is now inflicting such harm upon children with online gaming, psychiatric drugs, free reign of industries to pollute the environment, and toxic foods and chemicals, and now the privatization of education for profit. In other words, what is the nature of the predominant mental illness that pervades corporations, whether it is in entertainment, pharmaceutical, product manufacturing, that knowingly is involved in the destruction of so many kids and has no moral regard for the damage they are causing future generations?
Well, the subtitle of my earlier book, The Corporation, The Pathological Pursuit of Profit and Power, was based on, I had done a psychology degree as an undergrad, and then I went to law school, and I was sitting in my corporate law class in law school and hearing the professor explain the sort of legal DNA of the corporation as an institution. I thought, wow, that sounds an awful lot like a human psychopath, because the fundamental principle, the operating principle of a corporation is that the managers and directors have a legal obligation always to put the self-interest of the corporation above all other interests. So their job is to pursue wealth for the shareholders of the company, regardless of the consequences for others. which means that their job is either to exploit others and nature in order to create wealth, or to simply ignore the possible effects on others and nature as they go about pursuing wealth. And when you unleash that institution, unregulated and underregulated, on children, the results are fairly ominous, and that's what I document in my new book.
All right. There was a time when American government and society held the protection of children and only support environments that promote healthy childhood development as a morally mandated responsibility. Today, that culture is completely gone, and you identify that start of the new trend enabling corporations freedom to do as they wish to market to children, starting with President Reagan's repeal of laws that ruled kids programs should be educational and not solely for marketing. Go through this in greater depth and lead us to the present on how corporations have influenced and now control kids' laws.
Well, I think what happened, if you go back to the mid to late 19th century, you had children working in mines and mills and being quite heavily exploited as workers in the labor force. But you also had a set of ideas coming out of the European Enlightenment that essentially said childhood is a special time. It's not only a time when kids are vulnerable, but it's also a time when they have to kind of be developed as developing human beings. They have to be guided and nurtured and cultivated to become citizens, to become happy and fulfilled human beings as they progress through their development. And people started to say towards the end of the 19th century, you know, we really need to address this as a society. It's not enough simply to assume that parents are going to be able to protect their children from the economic forces that are rapidly developing during industrialization. So let's pass laws that say it's illegal to hire children. Let's pass laws that provide certain safety standards and provide certain health standards. Let's create public schools so that every child can have the benefit of an education. Let's do all these things. Let's take seriously the obligation of society to children, and let's craft laws and policies that reflect that obligation. Around 1980, that notion went out the window. And along with the more general rise of what I refer to as neoliberalism, the sort of cult of deregulation and privatization that began in the 1980s, along with all kinds of safeguards being thrown out the window, public interest safeguards, whether environmental or health and safety, went the various safeguards that were in place to protect children. And what emerged was a political environment, which we're still in, that essentially says there is no real role for government to step in and address the unique interests of children. And, you know, we've seen recently a number of disasters, and I've been listening with great interest to your discussion over the last few minutes and talking about some of these. Two obvious ones are the economic crash in 2008, and the near destruction of the Gulf of Mexico more recently. And in both cases, even people on the right are acknowledging that the problems were in large part the result of the fact that there weren't proper regulatory safeguards in place. And it's the same, I suggest in my book, with children and childhood, that we are putting ourselves in the position of creating a real crisis for our society by neglecting the interests and concerns and needs of young people.
I appreciate that overview. Thank you there, Joel.
You're welcome.
The most chilling, outrageous corporate control over children is discussed in your research into the manipulation of the Internet with online games and advertising. In particular, is the corporate use of what is called sentiment engines, which can track the mood of a child in order to influence the kind of advertising and entertainment sites, including Facebook, push on kids. Then there's also something called social graphs, and the increasing imagery of the violence and misogyny and sexism that infuses many of the more popular online games. So share with us some of the more outrageous examples and explain what do corporations know about a child's development that enables them to manipulate children's psychology and moods, and also share with us how profitable kids' marketing is to corporations.
Well, I think what has happened over the last, say, 10 years or so is that the principles of kid marketing, which have been in place since roughly the 1960s, have been greatly aided by technological developments. And what I mean by that is that the fundamental principles of marketing to children are two. The first is get around parents and aim directly at children. And do this in a way that not only gets around the parents, but actually undermines their influence. So a kind of deliberate attempt for marketers and marketing campaigns to insert themselves between children and their parents is the first principle. And the second, and you get these principles if you just read the marketing literature. You don't, have to dig too deep. The second principle is find out what the unique and most vulnerable emotions of children are, and then manipulate the hell out of those emotions in order to get kids to want and desire things. And, you know, those two principles have been operative for some time, but now with digital media and online media, they are manifest with particular power. And so you have, for example, with social network sites and whatnot, you have marketers now with the technology and the psychological knowledge being able to track what children's actual feelings might be over a day, what their sentiments are, what their desires are, and to target them individually. So this is a radical shift in marketing. You're no longer aiming at demographics, but rather you're aiming at psychographics. So you're trying to understand what an individual user is feeling and wanting, and then you're crafting a marketing campaign to that particular individual. And this is very powerful and very effective. And it means not only that you're crafting marketing campaigns to target individual kids as they're using their online platform, but you're also collecting lots of information about that individual. And you're having various algorithms analyze that information and create what's called a social graph, a kind of broad spectrum of who that person is. What are their wants? What are their desires? I mean, it sounds creepy, and it's very scary, and it's also very real. And the power, therefore, that marketers now have to kind of go deep into kids' psyches and really work them is quite profound. My 12-year-old son, he's now 14, actually, but he just pulled up for me something because he gets these ads on his when he's surfing the web and whatnot, and it says future PlayStations could read you like a book. Your hairdresser knows everything about you. So does your shrink. Soon it could be your PlayStation. Sony executives are apparently looking to give game consoles abilities that go beyond tracking your movement, but that actually now go into tracking the emotions of players and then targeting and working with those emotions as the kid is playing the game on PlayStation. So it's really going in a very, I think, ominous direction.
Many of the listeners right now will realize is the U.S. has some of the worst child laws for working in the developing world, particularly on farms and rural areas of states. This has resulted in frequent child injuries and deaths and has contributed to a rapid rise in illnesses. So what are the laws enabling employers to take advantage of child labor in the United States?
Well, it's very simple. There's an international convention that's sponsored by the United Nations that has been signed on to by most countries in the world, but not by the United States. And what that international convention says is that children should not be employed until they reach the age of 16. And that if they are employed before that, it should only be in context in ways that are designed to serve their interests rather than employers' interests. So various kinds of volunteer work or maybe making money, you know, cutting the grass of the neighbor, these sorts of things are okay. But traditional employment is not. And that treaty has been signed on to by some of the poorest nations in the world, such as Afghanistan and Haiti, who have passed laws in their countries to comport with that 15-year minimum requirement. The United States has not signed on to that and continues to allow children as young as 12 to work in the agricultural sector. And hundreds of thousands of children are working in the agricultural sector, and there are reports of children dying in this employment, of getting sick, of getting injured. Most of them are migrant children, some here on their own, some with their families. They're involved in picking fruit and in packing, often with unscrupulous employers, often in very unsafe and unhealthy conditions, constituting really some of the worst child labor taking place in the world today. And so while, you know, the U.S. government takes its sanctimonious positions about trying to eradicate child labor in the developing world, in its own backyard, it has some of the worst practices. And the real shame is that it's not only that it's legal for children to work when they're as young as 12 years old, but children much younger than that are working in the field, because even those minimal legal standards are so poorly enforced that, you know, a recent ABC investigative crew found on blueberry farms that kids as young as 5 years old were working. And the farm employers prefer kids for that age because they have very small hands and are better able to more quickly pick the blueberries. So it's really, you know, the grapes of wrath is still with us.
That's unfortunate. My final question for you. You summarized the market-driven Renaissance 2010 education campaign with three main objectives. One, failing schools should be closed just as failing businesses should be shut down. And two, rely on standardized tests to determine the success or failure of schools and individual teachers. And three, education should be run by private, profit-driven organizations and companies in order to implement a business model. So far, what has been the results of this kind of educational model, and what do you foresee being the educational level of children for their success in the future?
Well, there's this very broad movement happening in the United States right now, and it's unique to the United States, of essentially trying to privatize, both in terms of the culture and in terms of the actual structure, kindergarten to 12th grade education. And the elements that you mentioned, closing failing schools, standardized tests, private organizations running schools, are the central planks of it. There is no indication that this is creating more educated kids, or better educated, or more broadly educated kids. It has been driven, I believe, and I argue, primarily by both ideological concerns that somehow if schools run more like businesses, they'll be better. And I mean, in light of how businesses have been running over the last few years, I find that a little bit strange, to say the least. Also run by actual lobbying by a burgeoning education industry. There is a lot of money to be made out of standardized testing, out of managing schools, out of all of this, and this education industry wants to get a piece of it. I interviewed one fellow, Benno Schmidt Jr., who is quite involved in this movement. He used to be the head of Edison Schools, which is one of the large education management organizations. And he said, you know, next to medicine, education is the largest segment of our economy. And until quite recently, that segment of our economy was off limits to for-profit corporations. And one way of understanding what's going on within the current education movement is as basically a grab. The corporate America wants a piece of that very large segment of the economy, and increasingly through these reforms, it's getting a larger and larger piece of it.
I appreciate very much your good work. I look forward to another conversation with you, and all the best on your project.
Thanks so much, Gary. I really appreciate you having me on. I love your show.
Thank you. The book is Childhood Under Siege, How Big Business Targets Children. My guest, Professor Joel Bakan, B-A-K-A-N. Have a nice day, everyone.
The Gary Null Show is produced in our New York City studios. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matthew Bogart. All shows are archived by Kyle Pollard. Our chief archivist is Sharon Pride. And the program director is Jason Tabenfeld. I know